Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Valspar Ultra starts at just $29.98 a gallon. So we've got you covered when your daughter wants to paint her room again after last year's masterpiece of a unicorn mural.
Dad, please.
Or when you realize that maybe you went too hard on the greige.
I miss color.
Or when you were sure you wanted a home gym, but your elliptical is currently hanging your laundry.
What about a home office?
Shop everything you need for your next phase with Valspar. Available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
Let's talk.
John Brown.
Murder in Cairo, solving a Cold War spy mystery. On a warm night in December 1977, David Holden, chief foreign correspondent for the Sunday Times, landed in Cairo to report on crucial peace talks between Egypt and Israel. Shortly after dawn, however, his body was found dumped on a dusty roadside. He'd been shot with a single bullet through the head. Who killed Holden and why is the subject of Murder in Cairo? It's written by Emmanuel Midolo and Peter Gilman. I'm delighted to say that Peter Gilman joins me at the moment live on the line. Peter, good morning to you.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Thank you for joining me this morning. For those who don't know, explain a little bit about, if you would, the background to this story. I mean, who David Holden was, for a start.
Well, for a start, as we saw him at the time, he was the chief foreign correspondent of the London Sunday Times, very experienced, very respected, had worked also for other broadsheets, The Times and The Guardian. And he'd been sent to Cairo to report on some incredibly important prospective peace talks between Egypt and Israel, which was signified in a major change in the politics of the region.
At this time, the Sunday Times is under the stewardship of Harold Evans, so it's at its height of its crusading and investigative journalism.
Yes, it's a very nice way to put it, and I was very proud to be part of that. Harry Evans was one of the great editors of all-time journalism, and I feel very fortunate to have been there when he was the editor. And so when he said to me, after Holden's death was discovered, we want you to go to the Middle East and cover his traces, cover his tracks, I felt no hesitation in doing so. He was an editor you enormously respected and trusted, and he trusted you.
And so the timeline then, is that David had gone to cover on this. And again, this is 1977, you know, international situation is as bad as it ever was. There's, you know, we've got the PLO running around doing horrendous things as well, Yasser Arafat's gang. And so David arrives just to report on this and literally, obviously, in an era before mobile phones, etc., that he lands. Does he check in with the bureau there, or what happens?
He's on a 10-day swing through the Middle East, and the last stop is Cairo. He takes a late evening flight from Amman in Jordan to Cairo, arrives about 11 o'clock at night, and then, to all intents and purposes, disappears. And his body was found in a ditch near the airport that morning, taken to the Cairo mortuary, but it was lay there for about 3 days before anybody connected with Holden, and he was finally identified by a British journalist.
What was what was the reaction for everybody back at the? It was the Insight team, wasn't it? Which was the at the Sunday Times. Who were the?
That was the great investigative unit I was part. But the investigation broadened to encompass an awful lot of journalists, 6 in all, were sent to the Middle East after the body was identified. It was one of complete horror. I mean, to lose any journalist is just appalling. And sometimes they die when they're shot in conflict zones. This was a man who died reporting peace. That was the great irony. And Harry Ems in particular was distressed at the loss of a journalist who he enormously admired and respected.
So You went out. I mean, what was your original thought when you sort of landed and saw the lay of the land, and what was the reaction from the people when you were sort of digging around looking for an explanation to what had happened?
People were ostensibly very helpful. I was in Amman. There was another team in Cairo. Other people in Beirut and Jerusalem. And everywhere they said they'd be very helpful. And in particular in Cairo, the Egyptian police seemed to be going out of their way to help us, though we later had questions actually about how helpful they really were. It was quite an eerie time to be feeling that you were following in Holden's footsteps. The great worry was you'd meet the person who killed him and not know that that was the person you were talking to. We also had some very serious warnings. Harry said, beware of Mossad. That's the Israeli intelligence service, because the Sunday Times had run a very, very critical piece about Israeli treatment of Palestinians 6 months before. And that was thought could have been a motive. It could have been a revenge killing by Israel.
Well, I mean, looking at a situation here where, could you say that, because I was there wasn't actually an interview with Tina Brown that I caught over the weekend. And because she's had a conference called Truth Seekers, I believe it is, that she runs now. And she was talking about the fact that journalists are sort of seen as, it's not a profession that is looked at in a favorable light because of mainstream media and quote unquote legacy media, etc. And journalists at this time can be seen as perhaps as soft targets for if you are a regime that doesn't want anybody digging around. It's much easier to do harm to a journalist than it would be to do to an army official or somebody another thing of the state, as it were.
Yes, Tina, there was a conference in the week called Harry Evans Truth Tellers Summit that I was at. And it was very inspiring, but also very troubling, because the stories of how journalists around the world were being persecuted, murdered, as they went about their business. I don't think they are really soft targets, but the issue that arose in the Holden case was it became clear to us eventually that he'd been working as a spy. And it also became clear to us that a number of other journalists at the Sunday Times had been recruited by British intelligence. So the great anxiety was, did anybody in the Middle East, for example, when you pitched up to do your work as a journalist, did everybody assume you were also a spy? And I think that's something that Tina was alluding to. The minute you're there, walking around, you do feel vulnerable, because do they trust you or not? And the lesson of cases like this is that they've got every right not to trust us, at least that's how it seems.
And we've been joined in this chat now by Emanuele. Emanuele, are you hearing us loud and clear?
Yes, hi.
Good to have you with us. Just explain a little bit about what your role. Peter's been telling us a bit, if you like, about the historical background to the case. His reaction, obviously, we're talking about David Holden being sent out there, it must have been a bombshell revelation to you, Peter, that he'd been working as a spy then, because this is something that obviously you weren't party to and you weren't aware of.
Well, that was the key and most troubling thing. Just to clarify, I spent the best part of a year looking into this at the time in 1977 and 78. That was the conclusion we came to, that he had been working in intelligence. But who for? Possibly was he working for two people or two sides at once? That eluded us. Sometime later, a very long time later, more than 40 years later, I was talking to Manueli about all this, and he took up the baton, and he found out some astonishing and very troubling things about what Holden really been up to.
So Manu, we bring you in on this stage as well. Good morning to you. Just quickly, Peter came to you with this case. Presumably, this is a case that was happening we were in real time when you were very young, to put it mildly, or perhaps even before you were born. So what was your, which makes us all feel about 1,000 years old. So what was your reaction to when Peter was telling you about this case, this circumstance?
Yeah, I wasn't even born, actually. It was 10 years before I was born. But Peter trained me in investigative journalism. And he had all these great stories about the golden age of investigative journalism at the Sunday Times during the editorship of Harold Evans. And he would tell, fantastic tales. But then towards the end of his courses, he would say something along the lines of, I told you about my successes. Now let me tell you about the one time that we failed. And it was the David Holden case. And when Harry Evans died in 2020, he was in his 90s, I got in touch with Peter expressed my condolences. And Peter said that the last two times he'd met Harry, Harry was still troubled by the Holden case. And that's what hooked me, because, you know, the greatest editor of his generation, the greatest newspaper editor of all time here in Britain, was still obsessed with this case from, you know, 40 years earlier. And I started doing a bit of digging. There was obviously a lot of stuff that came available afterwards, because, you know, documents have been declassified. People had written memoirs. A lot of the people were dead. You know, a lot of the people were involved in this story in one way or another. So to me, it was one of those stranger than fiction investigations that, you know, it's the reason I became an investigative journalist to begin with. It was so far-fetched at times that, you know, if it'd been in a novel, you would think it was too much. It was too, you know, too elaborate to be true, but obviously it was all true.
There's a play by David Mamet, and I think when I spoke to John Sweeney about when he was in Ukraine about why he was doing what he was doing, and he said because the job of a journalist is to shine a light on things that people don't want to be shone on. As an investigative journalist, in this particular, both in the 70s and even now, people don't want light shining on Welly and Peter. So why did you, you know, did you, when you started picking up stones and moving rocks and shining torches on them, there are a lot of interests in there on every side. It's not just you're saying, okay, these are the bad guys, and their life is more complicated than black and white. There are various shades of in between. So if you start stirring up old memories or old facts that were disturbing to those, if they were young at the time, they may be positions of power by now. Isn't that a worrying thought in the back of both your minds? Well, are you first?
Well, I mean, yes, absolutely. The one thing that we discovered was that a lot of journalists didn't want to have, you know, these revelations come out in terms of the sort of murky connections between journalists and spies, because there was so much crossover back in the day, which is what we found. And then also when it comes to the authorities and some of the countries that were involved, they're just pushing back really hard, despite this being a court case from 47 years prior. So I wasn't expecting that much resistance from either, you know, some of the governments that we think were involved in this, and some of the characters as well. You know, as I said, a lot of people were dead, but the people who were still alive didn't want to talk to us, didn't want to engage. They seemed to be, you know, there seemed to be this great secret about what happened to David Holden. And some people had said, you know, previously that no one was going to get to the bottom of it. And that, to me, it was actually the motivation to push harder and as you say, you know, lift as many rocks as possible and shine a light on these events.
Peter, I'm thinking, because the thought just struck me, I mean, if you go back to when, you know, those days when news organizations could afford to have bureaus and stringers and people in all sorts of far-flung places, it was seen, and I'm thinking, obviously, Fleming springs to mind first of all, because there is that thin line in the days when we have empire, etc., and it's all the nation's interest. We have, you know, there has been sort of almost a patriotic thing for journalists to help out, and, you know, and especially if they're, you know, highly educated, if you know what I'm saying, if they come from particular schools or particular universities. I mean, do you think that David had been, that was one of the ideas, that my David was crossing that line between spying and reporting?
I think the media he came from and the time he came from, that seemed to be absolutely standard stuff. And there are a number of journalists who at the Sunday Times who are quite happily working for British intelligence and the Sunday Times at the same time. In his case, we thought that he had been approached by British intelligence, but we didn't think that was where his main work was. To get right to the point, our conclusion was he'd been recruited by the KGB, the Russian Secret Service, and that put him in the mould of others, like from Kim Philby, Burgess, and McLean downwards. So there was a tradition of that. He'd been at Cambridge, as that group were, so it fitted into that line. So it was not exceptional in that way. What was so disturbing was he got away with it so long. Even now, we can't answer all the questions about what precisely was going on, but everything very, very strongly pointed to that conclusion and also to the reasons why he'd been killed.
When you look at, did Holden have family? I mean, does Holden have family who are still around? Because obviously that, again, you are uncovering some things about, you know, about him that perhaps they wouldn't like to be come into public knowledge almost 50 years later.
Well, he had a nephew. He was married at the time. He was gay, and that was one of the keys to how he's recruited. He had a lavender marriage with his wife. And so there are all kind of levels of playing and deception involved in many aspects of his personal life. We did meet his nephew, who was very intrigued, the son of his brother. I talked to his brother at the time. Manuel and I interviewed his nephew, and he was very intrigued by what we found. He shared the sense of mystery with us and was also very intrigued to learn what we found. He was quite pleased to help, and he lent us some beautiful letters which Holden had sent to his parents, which we quoted from, and which showed something in Holden was yearning for a kind of stable family aspect of life, and when so much around him was about turmoil and deception.
It's fascinating, isn't it, but that particular group, and you mentioned Philby Burgess, you know, and Sir Anthony Blunt, of course, is the Queen's Eye historian for years before he's uncovered as a spy as well. It must seem like a different era, though, Manuel, when it comes to you researching, because this is an era we are the parallels between 45 years ago and now, and the fact that people still want to sort of cover up and it's still this, I was going to say great game, but you see what I'm saying? There's still a deception and double crossing and intrigue that is applicable today. So you're looking at what is, and apologies, Peter, and I'm, you know, not much younger than you, which now seems like old history. And for a current reporter, you must have seen some, did you see some striking parallels?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we, you know, for a moment, all this stuff, you know, the Cold War, the war between Russia and the US, was all remote. But obviously, you know, it's been a few years when we're living through a second Cold War in a way. So there's so many parallels between Holden's story and what's happening now. I mean, Holden went to the Middle East to cover a peace conference between Egypt and Israel. And, you know, I went to Egypt at a time when October 7th attack just happened. And, you know, there was a prospect of all-out war in the Middle East. So the parallels are striking. When it comes to journalists and spies, I would think that things have changed. And when people ask me, you know, do you think there are spies in the newsroom? Possibly, but I would think these days the spies are probably working IT rather than journalism, if you allow me to say that.
Yeah, well, you just have, so there you go. So there's not a lot I can do to extract that particular statement. Peter, I mean, it just raises the question, though, you know, as you said a little earlier on the interview, if people working for national and international newspapers were actively working for espionage and sending reports, that put everybody in danger. Because every journalist who goes out into the field then could be considered a spy by a foreign power, and therefore they could be dealt with as spies. Did the revelation that he was a spy, and B, did that change the way that you looked at him? Because obviously you knew him personally.
You raised a very troubling question. You did, when we realised, I was quite naive about all this, but when I discovered that it was commonplace for British journalists to be working as spies, it made me very wary, because I think I talked to one Middle East official who said the safest thing for us to assume is any British journalist is a spy, which is very troubling, because you didn't know how you could be trusted, and it was a very dubious double game to get into, which I was absolutely, when I had approaches, I was absolutely strong and said, I'm not interested in helping you at all. I'm not going to betray my profession. The second part, I've forgotten what the second part was.
Did it change the way that you looked at him? And obviously,
yes,
with
it
this,
did. Yeah. Yes, it did. We knew quite an early stage there were layers to him, and that he was an actor and a player of that kind, and he was role-playing and playing different roles. It certainly made me very troubled about him. And to think that someone who could present himself in the way that he did was working for other masters, I think was a betrayal of the profession. I mean, quite apart from that, he was betraying his country by spying for the KGB. I was left with no respect for him at all. I just thought this was a shameful thing to be doing, not least because he was betraying journalism.
Just thinking, because we live in an age now where it seems to be get the news out as opposed to where it was before, when we were told to get the sources correct, then get the story out. Now we live in get the story out now and then get the sources. And an awful lot of people would call journalism is taken from social media. There is no or a tweet or whatever you call it these days. There is no substitute for boots on the ground, if you like, or leather work and on your shoe leather. So again, getting out there, walking the ground, as it were, was invaluable to, because people say, oh, well, investigative journalism is dead, gone and long buried. Presumably you are living, walking proof to that lie.
Thank you. That's very kind. I always say, you know, the techniques of investigative journalism between 1977, when Peter was investigating the Holden case initially, and now, haven't changed much. Obviously, I can now retrieve information in seconds. I can check names. I can see if people are still alive. I can see where they live. I can try to contact them straight away. But in terms of actually going out, as you say, you know, the shoe leather reporting, that is still the same. It's still asking, uncomfortable questions to people. It's still looking them in the eye and see what their reaction to your findings are. And I think this is crucial. I mean, it was such a privilege for me to work on this case, to be able to retrace Peter's steps and to go out to meet people, to talk to them face to face, travel to these countries and see, you know, where these great investigative journalists from a different era have been operating. It was just the privilege of my professional life.
Tina Brown wrote the forwards to this book. And, you know, if people don't know, Tina Brown and Harry Evans were the ultimate media power couple. Tina is a force of nature, editor at Tatler when she was 25, editor of Vanity Fair when she was 30. Absolutely, you know, absolutely an icon for those of us in the world of media. And does this, she still feels very strongly about this case because the way it affected her late husband, Peter?
Yes, she does. And it was a shared mission for her. She was so pleased that we'd taken up the case, the one that the great regret of Harry's life. We talked to her quite a lot about it. And she was thrilled and excited we'd taken up, and even more thrilled and excited that we cracked it. And also, we thought, uncover the name of the person who'd been stealing telexes, that's internal messages at the Sunday Times, which was one of the great shocks we had to deal with. Someone was stealing the messages we were sending back to the Sunday Times when we were doing our investigation, and also stolen some of Holden's own messages, telexes. She was thrilled that we cracked that. I met her at told you that we were at the Truth Tellers Summit, and in the evening, there was a lot of very crowded people meeting and chatting. And she walked towards me and I just said, "We did it." And there was moistness in her eyes and she just patted me very gently. And it was a lovely, moving moment.
What are you hoping that people will take from your investigation, from this book, Peter? What do you hope that people learn?
I think they learn a lot about the nature of journalism, and they learn a lot about why journalism shouldn't be compromised. It's a cracking tale, I have to say. I only wrote half of it, so I can pray in Manu's heart. It's written quite beautifully, the way he unravels the mystery which I set up in the first half. I just the best praise we get is when people say it's a great read, and I feel very honoured to have helped construct such a nice narrative.
And Manu, in an era where we are forever being told that we are the mainstream media or the legacy media or we don't matter, surely this is going to prove that investigative journalism still matters, it's still relevant, and that journalism still gets, it's still an integral part, even more so now than before when this tale is written.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the greatest compliment that I get is some young journalist, you know, younger than me, approaching me and telling me, you know, I love the book. It's almost like a textbook of investigative journalism, because what we did is what we I felt that Peter's story, you know, the story of the investigation was the story of the book as well as Holden's life. It wasn't just his life and his death. The story of Peter and his colleagues trying to find the truth was the, you know, at the heart of it. And the way I tried to write it, to write the second part was, you know, to describe how the second investigation went and describe the sort of the techniques of investigative journalists these days, which, you know, a lot of people don't necessarily understand. And I was, you know, I was pleased when people approached me and tell me, you know, I learned so much from the book.
The book is called Murder in Cairo, Solving a Cold War Spy Mystery. You can order it via our own virtual bookstore as well on the TRE website. It's by Peter Gilman and Emanuele Midolo. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.